Yeah, Pajar. Tidili Dorwa. I think the first you should recite in Sanskrit.
So first we will have the recitation of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, Heart Sutra, in Sanskrit. And then there will be the recitation of the Heart Sutra in Latvian today. So you thought this was inquiring about the way the translators are, and we are, and so usually when we have this kind of Dharma discourse, I ask to recite the Mangala Sutra in Pali, but today, since we don't have that, since in the Sanskrit tradition, the main teaching of the Buddha are the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, we will have the recitation of the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit first. My friend Tenzin Priyadarshini has come here, and so I ask him to recite it.
Yes.
The Blessed Mother, the Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom, in Sanskrit, Bhagavati Prankyaparamita Hridaya, thus have I heard the Blessed One was staying in Rajagriha at Wiltshire Peak, along with the great community of monks and great community of bodhisattvas. And at that time, the Blessed One was sent. Blessed One entered the meditative absorption and the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound. At that time as well, the Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, clearly beheld the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom itself as, and so that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Thereupon, through the Buddha's inspiration, the Venerable Shariputra spoke to the Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, and said, how should any noble son or noble daughter who wishes to engage in the practice of the perfection of wisdom train? When this had been said, the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, spoke to the Venerable Shariputra and said, Shariputra, any noble son or noble daughter who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom should clearly see this way. They should see perfectly that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. And form too is not other than emptiness. Likewise, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are all empty. Therefore, Shariputra, all phenomena of emptiness. They are without defining character. They are not born, they do not cease, they are not defined, they are not undefiled, they are not deficient, and they are not complete. Therefore, Shariputra, in the end, there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no mental formation, no conscience, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. There is no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no texture, and no mental formation. There is no eye element, and so on up to, and no mind element, including up to, no mental consciousness element. There is. Thank you. No. And then we will have the recitation of in Latvian language. Perhaps this is the first time we have recited it. This is the second time. There is no eye element and so on up to, no mind element, including up to, no mental consciousness. Element of mental consciousness, there is no... There is no ignorance. There is no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Likewise, there is no suffering, no cessation, no... No suffering, no origination, no cessation or path. There is no wisdom, no attainment, and even no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no attainments, then they rely on this perfection of wisdom and abide in it, having no obscuration in their minds. They rely on this perfection of wisdom and abide in it, having no obscuration in their minds, they have no fear, and by going utterly beyond error, they will reach the end of nirvana. All the Buddhas, too, who abide in the three times, attain the full awakening of unexalted perfect enlightenment by relying on this profound perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know that the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unexalted mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that quells all suffering is true because it is not deceptive. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed that Yatha Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhisvaha Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, the great being, should train in the perfection of wisdom this way. Thereupon the Blessed One arose from that meditative absorption and commended the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, saying, "This is excellent, 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 noble, O noble child, it is just so, it should be just so. One must practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have it revealed. For then even the Tathagatas will rejoice as Blessed One uttered these words, the Venerable Shariputra, the Holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, along with the entire assembly in including the worlds of gods, humans, Asuras and Gandharvas, all rejoiced and hailed what the Blessed One had said.
Nav augstākās gudrības, nav sasniegšanas un nav nesasniegšanas. Tādējādi Šāriputra, tā kā bodhisattvām nav sasniegšanas, bodhisattvas paļaujas un mīt gudrības pilnveidošanā ar neaptumšotu prātu un bez bailēm. Pilnīgi aizgājuši viņas pildīšanās, viņas sasniedz gala punktu nirvānu. Arī visi Budas, kas mīt trijos laikos, sasnieguši pilnu nepārspējamo pilnīgu apgaismības atmodu, paļaujoties uz dziļo gudrības pilnveidošanu. Tādējādi gudrības pilnveidošanas mantra, augstākā zināšanas mantra, nepārspējamā mantra, nesalīdzināmajam līdzīgā mantra, visas ciešanas nomierinošā mantra ir patiesa, jo tā nav maldinoša. Gudrības pilnveidošanas mantra ir pasludināta. Tā, ja tā, gati, gati, pāra, gati, pārušam, gati, bodhisoha. Šāriputra, bodhisattvām, dižajām būtnēm, šādi jāmigrinās dziļā gudrības pilnveidošanā. Tai brīdī svētais pārtrauc teic cēlu Avalokiteshvara bodhisattva dižo būtni teikdams. Labi teikts, dēls ar labu izcelsmi. Tieši tā, kā tu norādīji, tieši tādā veidā ir jāveic dziļā gudrības pilnveidošanas praksi, tad arī visi tatagātas priecāsies. Tad, kad svētītājs bija bildi šos vārdus, ieliksmojās cienījamais Šāriputra un cēlājs Avalokiteshvara bodhisattva dižā būtne, un visi tur sanākušie, un arī pasaules dievi, cilvēki, pusdievi un gandārvas, un visi augstu slavēju šo svētītā vārdus.
Tūdžiče, thank you.
I pay homage to the Gautama who moved by his compassion towards the sacred Dharma, sublime Dharma, to rid us of all distorted views. So in Latvia, once again in Latvia, in order to explain Buddhism, we have this opportunity for the explanation of the teaching of the Buddha. And so I would like to thank all the organizers. 1 year in Latvia, I when I gave an introductory teaching on Buddhism, one Russian came to me and told me that because of economic constraint, many Russians face difficulty to come to India for your teachings, for my teachings, and therefore to come here to Russia, Latvia, and receive teachings would be very good for these poor Russians. And so I also felt quite sad when I heard it. And that's true. It's true that there are people who are really interested, but they have economic constraint. And therefore, I said, I'll see to it. I cannot decide it myself alone, but I... and so I discussed with my friends, and they said that my friends told me that they actually support me if I hold this teaching teaching in Latvia, and therefore we have once again this opportunity for the Dharma discourse, and a huge number of people have come here, and first of all, welcome to you, my greetings to everyone. So all of us are same in being human beings. Me, regarding myself, who face you and talk to you, I'm also a human being like you. All the 7 billion human beings are same. There's no difference amongst us. Or we were born the same way from our mother's womb, all the 7 billion people. And at the end, we all die, will die. And in that sense also, we are all same and not different. And therefore, all 7 billion people, we are mentally, emotionally, and physically same. We are all same. I consider this very important to recognize this oneness of humanity. So why is it important? All 7 billion people are same in not wanting suffering but wanting happiness, yet making divisions among us, saying them and they and us, and then trying to bully others and deceive others, and even going to the length of killing each other. Today, we are gathered here, we are peaceful, but at the same time, on this earth, in some places, people are killing each other. All of them are also same like us human beings. So that while we are same at that basic level, as human beings, without recognizing that, without acknowledging that, but then talking about the division amongst us, like nations or family lineage, and then religion, and making this division between us and them, and then killing each other. And this has become like a normal kind of a way of living. This is totally wrong. So even if you think on the level, on an individual level, if the entire humanity is in peace and friendship, love and compassion, I mean, one individual will automatically benefit. While the whole humanity is full of all kinds of negative emotions and then overcome with this discrimination between us and them, then the individuals also suffer. We will not, as individuals, not benefit. And therefore, from amongst this 7 billion people, I am one of them. And so, if the whole humanity is peaceful, happy, and calm, and we all have this responsibility to create such a world, and therefore, wherever I travel, I meet with different people, so I always emphasize this oneness of humanity and to have this sense of responsibility of the entire humanity. So this actually, I came up with this idea in 1973 when I first visited Europe. So where there is already there was great material development and progress, but I found that people were not happy, not peaceful, there's all kinds of fear and anxiety. So I witnessed, observed that, and therefore I admire the European Union, the spirit of European Union. So Europe is a continent where there have been fightings amongst the different nations, but taking into account the reality of the time, then people thought, considered the interest of the whole of Europe more important. And then these days there are people who talk about being a citizen of the world, the global citizen, and then also they talk about one world. And so these are things that give us hope. And therefore, as one of the 7 billion people on this earth, I sincerely talk about promoting this oneness of humanity, the sense of oneness of humanity. So if we have that sense of oneness of humanity, then naturally we'll have respect for each other, love and compassion for each other, and even if we are not able to help one another, we will not at least harm one another. And so this is very important. And then, similarly, on the basis of the different religious faiths, there is division caused. This is what we see. For example, in Syria today, people in that area, in that region, are all followers, same follower, praying to Allah and following Quran. But then people actually divide between Shia and Sunni. Therefore, there's this division, and I feel it very important to promote religious harmony. As a practitioner of Buddhism, as a follower of the Buddha, and I've lived in India for many years, and India is a country which has the greatest population, and it's a democratic country. Of course, there are problems, but for thousands of years, over 2,000 years, there have been these religions which have actually taken birth in India itself, such as Sankhya school, Jainism, and also Vedanta, and also Buddhism, and so these homegrown religions are there in India. And then on top of that, Zoroastrianism came to India. It is said that in Persia itself, there are very few who follow this tradition, Zoroastrianism. And so in India, the majority of the Parsis live in Mumbai. So there are maybe less than 100,000, but they live peacefully, following their own religion, such as worshipping, doing some worship of ritual of fire. And then there is the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam as well that emigrated from the Middle East to India. So all these religions, immigrant religions, also live in India in harmony. And therefore, all the major religious traditions of the world live, exist in India, and they live together harmoniously. So, of course, as human society, there will be problems amongst humans, but India practically, all these religions live together, coexist for thousands of years. So if this is possible in India, then, of course, the different countries in the world, the different continents, I mean, there were not much communication and interaction amongst each other in the past, but today, when people actually divide themselves, saying us and them on the basis of religion, if we could create a harmony amongst religions, so I think that if this is possible in India, it should be possible in the whole of the world as well. And therefore, I work for the promotion of religious harmony. So these different religious traditions, regarding them, I usually, with regard to the major religious traditions, I actually describe them in three different aspects. One is, the first one is the religious aspect. So regarding this, all religions teach love, compassion, tolerance, and forgiveness, and self-discipline, as well as not only practicing tolerance, but practice forgiveness. And so these are religious aspects of the major religious traditions. And then the second dimension is the philosophical concept, where there is big difference between the religions. So, for example, in the case of Indian homegrown religions like Sankhya school and so forth, there are two camps within them. There are those of the theistic religions and non-theistic. And within the non-theistic ones, there are those who assert a theory of Atman and those who deny that. And so all religious traditions, most of the religious traditions of the world are theistic religions, which believe in a creator God. So, for example, in Indian religious tradition, theistic religions, they believe in Ishwara as the creator of the world. So this those who follow the theistic religions are quite numerous. And then all the religions of the world, except Buddhism, assert a self or an Atma or soul, which is separate from the five psychophysical aggregates, whereas Buddhism rejects that. But all these philosophical differences, different philosophical concepts, have their own benefit. So the religions, these different religions, have spread in different geographical regions at different times, and therefore the disciples who follow them, due to the climatic differences and the people's way of living, I mean, they have different habits, and then there are different cultures that have spread in different regions of the world, different countries of the world, and accordingly, because of this cultural difference, the people's thinking also are different. Definitely, there are differences in there. And therefore, in accordance with these different mental dispositions, their interest and proclivity and character and so forth, we have these different religious traditions that have spread in the different parts of the world. For example, in the case of the teaching of the Buddha himself, of course, Buddha taught the selflessness, which is his own position with regard to how things are. But sometimes he also has taught some of his disciples as if there is some kind of a element of a self or a soul. When he said that the five psychophysical aggregates are the loads, and so which are the things that are appropriated, and then there those who carry the one who carries these loads is the person. And so in this way, when he seems to be indicating there is a self which is separate or from the psychophysical aggregates, although the actual teaching of the Buddha himself about selflessness, but for some of his disciples, he has taught in this way, as if there is a separate self other than these psychophysical aggregates. And then in other sutras, for example, the sutra unraveling the thought, the Buddha has said that there is no external objects, but the subject of mind exists. And then in other sutras, he said there are external objects do exist, internal experiencer also exist, and so there are different ways the Buddha taught, the same teacher. So although all these different philosophical schools follow the same teacher, the Buddha, I mean, within the Buddhism, we can see these different philosophical ideas and concepts. For example, Master Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, and so forth follow Madhyamaka school of thought, whereas Master Asanga and Vasubandhu and so forth, they followed Chittamatra school. So, all of these masters were following the same teacher, the Buddha, but amongst these disciples of the same teacher, we have these different philosophical schools. And therefore, taking this as an example, from amongst the 7 billion people, there are over a billion people who have no religious faith as such, but the remaining do have the religious faith. But therefore, we need different philosophical thoughts and ideas, concepts. But these different philosophical ideas have the same purpose, which is to promote and spread love and compassion. And so from the religious point of view, all the religions have the same goal of promoting love and compassion. They teach the same, have the same message, but these different philosophical ideas that are taught have this goal of actually boosting this love of practice of love and compassion. So with regard to the theistic religions, for example, the followers feel that everything in the universe is created by the God. So for example, people gathered here are creation of the God. But they say that this God, the creator, the nature of it, this God is love, infinite love and compassion. And so such an infinite love, God, has created us, and therefore they feel that we are all same creature of the God. So the theistic religious traditions generally do not assert any past and future lives. This very life was created by God for them. And therefore, when you think along these lines that this very life was created by the God, then they could feel very close to God. And therefore, with that feeling that our Father, the Creator, the God, when they have this kind of conviction, then they also feel the need to practice love. Very strong feeling could be there. And so this, because of this, theistic religious traditions are also good. So regarding those of the non-theistic religions, Jainism and Buddhism today are the ones who do not believe in a creator God. And then there is also belief in past and future lives. Although in other non-Buddhist traditions of India, they do have this belief that everything was in the beginning created by God, but then due to their karmas, beings take go from one life to the other. And therefore, when you talk about karma, the responsibility of one's pain and pleasure is actually put on one's own shoulder. If you want pleasant experience, happiness, you need to create the causes that are positive karma in order to experience or reap this kind of the fruit of happiness. Whereas if you don't want suffering, you should avoid creating the negative karmas which results in these painful experiences. And therefore, these religions also talk about creating happiness and avoiding suffering. And there is also the talk about, the emphasis on love and compassion. And so all religious traditions, we can conclude, have the same purpose of creating a peaceful, loving world. And so in accordance with the, and although they have the same message of love and compassion, they have the different philosophical ideas and concepts. And therefore, we must respect all these religions, and which help benefit many of their followers. And therefore, we should make this distinction between faith, keeping faith in one's own religion, while respecting the people following the other religious traditions. And so I always make this a point of promoting religious harmony. And then the third aspect of all these major religions is a cultural aspect. So because of a certain habits or lifestyles of the different communities, this also has some influence on the religious traditions. In the past, people were following more or less a feudal system. So since the religions, different religions actually evolved within such a cultural background or feudal system, this must also have some influence. And so there are certain aspects, cultural aspects, which could be modified. For example, in Jainism, this emphasis, strong emphasis on avoiding killing and not and practice of non-violence, and therefore taking to vegetarianism. And so Mahavira, the founder of Buddha, Jainism, when he appeared in the world in India, at that time, it is said that there was huge animal sacrifice in India that had spread as part of religious practice. And this was said to have negative impact on the economy of the people, the farmers. And therefore, Mahavir emphasize the practice of vegetarianism and non-violence. Within such a cultural background, and then the Buddha, the fourth amongst a thousand Buddhas to appear in this world, also emphasized not harming others and practicing non-violence. And regarding Islam, there is the Sharia law, when Muhammad appeared in the Middle East region, in Saudi Arabia and so forth, the people were living maybe more or less as nomads. No fixed place they live, but they kind of called travel from one place to the other. And whereas if people were living together in one as one community in one place and with law, I mean, it would be different. So because this was not there, the Quran actually mentions the Sharia law. And so this was in accordance with, these laws were put in practice in accordance with the people's habits or lifestyle in that time. And so there may be some aspects which could be changed and modified. And then in India, there is the caste system, which where they say, in which they say that the four different castes in India actually came or evolved from the four faces of Brahma. And today, the lower castes have they have special problems within the communities. And so, although this caste system was said to have actually come from the religious belief, but the times have changed. We are now in a world where we follow democracy, and everyone is equal in the eyes of the law. And the Buddha himself has said that in my tradition, my religion, the caste system is not important, but the practice of the Dharma is more important. And one of the followers or disciples of the Buddha was Upali, and who was from a lower caste at that time. But because of his knowledge and experience of the spirituality, I mean, even he was considered as someone worthy of veneration from people from maybe higher castes who came to the Buddha. And then, because of this system of kings ruling the people, and in order to suppress people and oppress them, I mean, you can see there is some element of the societal kind of influence, influence of the whole the system that was followed in the communities and societies at that time. So I have appealing to other spiritual brothers and sisters that this caste system is not good, that it should be changed. And in Ladakh also, there are people who were considered of low caste. And therefore, quite some time ago, long time ago, I have been appealing that this must be abandoned. And so people in Ladakh who are considered as from lower caste, the people from the higher caste do not even take meals or drinks from their hands. Whereas there's no need to change the basic teaching of all the religious traditions, which is the practice of the message of love and compassion, we don't need to change that. And then the philosophical ideas and concepts also need not be changed, but the cultural aspect of these religions, in accordance with the reality today, we need to adapt and change and modify or change them. And so, in short, the theistic and non-theistic religious traditions, and those who assert self or non-self have the same goal, which is the promotion of love and compassion. And therefore, we need to respect all religious traditions, and they are needed in this world. So with this recognition, and just because we have philosophical differences, we must not create this distinction or make the discrimination between us and them. And therefore, we need to respect all religious traditions of the world. And together with this, the concept of, amongst the religious tradition, there is this concept of one truth and one religion, and several and another idea, which is the several truth and several religion. If you look at them, they seem to be contradictory, but in terms of an individual, one religion, one truth, one religion is relevant to keep one's own belief and faith and to intensify them and within oneself, and to hold this idea of one religion and one truth is relevant. But when it comes to more than one person or a society, we have people who, even in one family, who follow different religions, which is good. So in terms of the society, it's a reality where to follow to believe in multiple religion and multiple truth. So in India, for thousands of years, this has existed. And so this is what we need. This understanding of multiple truth, multiple religion, or several truth and several religion is something relevant, practical in today's world. Whereas people who lived rather in isolation from others, sometimes they, because of their short-sightedness or narrow-mindedness, they only may say there is only one truth and one religion. So religious tradition, religious harmony is very important from amongst the people gathered here today, my brothers and sisters in religion. Please do whatever you can to the best of your ability to reflect on this point of religious harmony. If you consider me as your Dharma friend in spirituality, so all the religious traditions which have different philosophical ideas, we must respect all of them because of the emphasis on the same message, which is love and compassion. And then if you could actually work for religious harmony, then you would be my friends. And here, I'm here to explain the teaching of the Buddha. So with regard to the teaching of the Buddha, according to the Pali tradition of Buddhism, the Buddha, until he sat under the Bodhi tree, and then became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, he was considered as, in the beginning when he started sitting under the Bodhi tree, he was considered as four Buddha bodies. And so when we could explain on the basis of such an idea, and we can actually go through evidence or the logical proof that the Buddha Buddhahood is possible. Otherwise, just becoming a Buddha in one lifetime, just like that, may be difficult to prove. So from the point of view of Buddha, and it is said that in the Mahayana Uttara Tantra, the Buddhas manifest in the form bodies, the physical dimension of the Buddhahood, from within this meditation absorption of in emptiness. And so someone who has and therefore within the physical dimension of a Buddha arising from that the wisdom body, we have the Sambhogakaya, which is accessible to beings who are called Arya beings, and then the Nirmanakaya, the emanation body, which is accessible to even as ordinary beings, beings who have pure karma. And so we have these classic texts which are taught through reason and logic, and written by the 17 Nalanda masters. And so, when the within the teaching of the Buddha, there is the Pali tradition, which has its own explanation and called description of the Buddha, and the Sanskrit tradition, which says that the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, was an supreme emanation body, who and was born, who enacted as the Buddha deed of being born as in the royal family, and then renouncing by seeing the different events in his life. I mean, he renounced his royal life and went to the Niranjana River. Of course, before that, he sat in meditation and practiced austerity for 6 years. After it, which shows that it's not enough just to leave home, to become homeless and renunciant, but we need to practice. And therefore, the Buddha sat for 6 years of practice of austerity, and practiced and cultivated the single point of concentration, and then went to the under the Bodhi tree near the Niranjana River, and he enacted the deed of enlightenment of a Buddha. So after becoming enlightened, the Buddha, of course, has given these teachings on how to wear the monastic robes. And regarding the teaching of the Buddha, he taught that this nectar-like teaching, and then the other the first five human disciples who lived with the Buddha in meditation, and they found him to be somebody special, and then as time was ripe, the Buddha gave the first sermon in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is the sermon on the Four Noble Truths, which is very important because it is like the big the framework for the teaching of the Buddha. The teachings within the Pali tradition and Sanskrit tradition could be explained on the basis of the Four Noble Truths. Wherever Buddhism has spread, both the Pali and the Sanskrit traditions, we can explain the teaching of the Buddha on the basis of these Four Noble Truths. So there may be some differences within the Sanskrit and Pali traditions, but all of them teach the Four Noble Truths, and the 16 characteristics, four of each of the Four Noble Truths. And so with regard to these, all followers of Buddhism have the same teaching, and the Four Noble Truths is taught on the basis of understanding the law of causality. Whereas the Buddha, when he said he found this profound, peaceful, and non-fabricated, which means that non-fabrication here means that things are have come through dependence. And with independence, there is the dependence of causality. And therefore, with regard to the Four Noble Truths, in connection with the Four Noble Truths, we can correlate this law of causality with pertaining to the samsaric existence and law of causality pertaining to liberation. So first two Noble Truths pertain to the law of causality. I mean, could be explained on the basis of law of causality that pertain to the samsaric existence. And the last two Noble Truths, Noble Truth of Cessation and Path, can be come within the understanding of this law of causality pertaining to liberation. And therefore, in other words, this teaching on the Four Noble Truths is based on the understanding of law of causality. And then we have each of these four Noble Truths have the four characteristics, which are... And so this becomes, which make up 16 for characteristics of the Four Noble Truths. The four characteristics of suffering are that those of impermanence, suffering, empty, and then selflessness. And so since the first the teaching on the Four Noble Truths was given and rather in a public, then therefore they have actually been recorded in history, and the conventional history, whereas with regard to the teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom discourses, they were given to beings who have rather advanced further. For example, we can use the analogy of the classes in our school system. I mean, they have reached a higher level of class, having gone through the lower classes. And therefore, for those who have advanced further and who had also become receptive to the teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom, and the Buddha gave this teaching. And then amongst his audience, there were also not only human beings, but the bodhisattvas, deities, such as Maitreya, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and so forth. And so we have usually the mention of eight bodhisattvas who are considered as the close disciples, bodhisattva disciples of the Buddha. For example, we can, in the Heart Sutra that we said, we can find this dialogue between Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara. And so the disciples who received the Vajraparamita teachings were the ones who have pure karma and... And in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, I mean, of course, this was not taught in public. And therefore, since it was didn't become recorded, I mean, in history, therefore there are people who, I mean, there were people in India in those ancient times that who said that the Mahayana is not teaching of the Buddha. Of course, the term Mahayana comes in these Perfection of Wisdom teachings, and that they were created or by later masters. But we find in Master Nagarjuna's texts, as well as Bhavviveka and Shantideva, who have argued for Mahayana being the teaching of the Buddha, the words of the Buddha. So because there were people who actually argued that Mahayana was not taught by the Buddha, there were these arguments against them. And today, even today, we have such people who say Mahayana is not teaching of the Buddha. And so, with regard to the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, the teaching on the Perfection of Wisdom discourses, these explain in detail what is the true cessation. And then, within the objective domain of the path, the spiritual path, and there are different degrees of subtlety within that. I mean, this is also explained in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. And therefore, because the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, the subtlest philosophical view, the deepest and subtlest philosophical view, I mean, therefore, we have the other views which are coarser to that. For example, the coarser philosophical view of self, for example, with regards to a permanence, I mean, which include this view of a permanent, single and autonomous self, and then substantially existent, self-sufficiently existing self. And then there is also the selflessness of persons, and then and then also there is the explanation in a philosophical view that external things do not exist, which is very similar to quantum physicists explain. In the Chittamatra school of philosophy within Buddhism, which says that because an object like a blue color and its perception, consciousness apprehending the, perceiving the blue, because they are seen simultaneously arising, therefore there's no, they are not substantially different, which says that the perception of a blue color comes because of our imprints for a blue color from the past, and therefore the blue is a reflection of the perception itself. And so this is very similar to what the quantum physicists say these days, that there is nothing objectively existing, as well as in order to say that, they say that as long as there is an observer, there is an object, observed object. Whereas scientists, even the quantum physicists and so forth, have not focused on the mind, the internal experience as such. In the past, there were no explanation of how the mind works in detail. But today, even scientists see the importance or significance of the experience within the mind, and therefore, people see that when we experience emotional emotional experiences, and or some experience within, when they see that these experiences impact our brain as well, and so they say that there is something other than the brain which actually affects or impacts it. So with regards to the explanation the physicists say is when they say that there is no external objectively existing thing, do they mean that there is nothing really out there existing as external objects, or what? We could still do further research on it. And with regards to the Buddhist idea of emptiness, I mean, it's Buddhist and philosophy. One Indian nuclear physicist, Raja Ramana, whom I have met, told me that the basic concept, the concept of what we talk in quantum physics, actually existed, already existed more than 2,000 years ago in India. And so at that time when he told me this, I wasn't aware of quantum physics. And then later when I took interest in learning about quantum physics, I mean, they really explained, the explanation they give is very similar to the mind-only school of philosophy, which say that there is no external objects. I mean, no external objects exist. So this is taught in the sutras, such as the Sandini Mochana Sutra. And then, with regard to emptiness, or selflessness. There is also different interpretations from other schools. So within the explanation of the selflessness of phenomena, for example, there are different interpretations from the different philosophical schools. And there is this philosophical school who say that who talk about non-duality of subject or object, and saying, and then philosophical school which says that nothing objectively exists, nothing has any self-defining characteristic, and so forth. And so, as I explained earlier, with regards to the different ideas such as impermanence and so forth. And with regards to impermanence and then selflessness and so forth, the Four Noble Truths and so forth, in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, the Buddha goes through the different objects on which he establishes that of emptiness. For example, in this Heart Sutra, we find mentioned that the things do not have any inherent existence or intrinsic nature. And so this is this qualification is used, which doesn't mean that things as such do not exist, because then that would be going against our own experience. Because of the form, the physical things like sight and smell, taste, and so forth, we can talk about having this the cognition of these visual objects, sound, and so forth. And so, when the Perfection of Wisdom teachings say, this does not exist, this does not exist, no, like that, I mean, what this teach is that things have no intrinsic or independent existence. And so when you explain emptiness or teach emptiness, there are the objects on which you establish emptiness. And so there are those of the objects, such as form and so forth, and then the path system, and then the resultant state. And so on the basis of these different objects, we define or explain emptiness. And so the Perfection of Wisdom teachings have an explicit teaching, explicit content, which is emptiness, which is taught by or further explained by Master Nagarjuna and his followers. And then we have the implicit content of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, which are the hidden in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, and which were explicated by masters like Asanga and his followers. And in the Maitreya's Abhisamaya Alamkara, for example, we find mention of the 70 different topics, which are the implicit content of the Panchaparamita teachings. So we need to understand both of these, the explicit content and the implicit content of perfection wisdom. So in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Master Nagarjuna, for example, he says, not from self, not from another, neither from causelessly, and not from both, and neither. So they use logical reasoning to prove the reality of things on the basis level, the path, and the resultant level. And then, because of the importance of logic and reasoning, we have in Nalanda tradition, masters like Dignaga and the Dharmakirti writing texts on epistemology, logic and reason, separately. So in order to establish or demonstrate the reality of the ground or the basis, path, and the result, not just resorting to scriptural authority. And so the source for this emphasizing on logic and reasoning is in one sutra where the Buddha says, O monks and scholars, just as a gold is tested by burning, cutting, and polishing, or likewise, you should test my teaching and accept it, not because you have devotion or faith in me. And so the Buddha says, my followers, you monks and scholars, must not believe in my teaching because of the reason that you are my disciples or followers. But he says, you must actually analyze and investigate, examine the teaching. And when you see the significance of these teachings after your investigation, and you should actually not just investigate like that, but test it if it is helpful and beneficial to you in your practice. And if you are able to verify its significance through your own experience, through your practice, then you should accept the teaching. So, of course, I respect all religious traditions, but there's no one, the founder of any religion who has said like something like this, that his followers must actually check his teaching, not just take them out of faith. And therefore, masters like Nagarjuna and so forth also put the teaching of the Buddha under this scrutiny, and then they said that such and such teachings, there are such and such teachings which cannot be taken literally, and therefore we cannot accept them literally. Whereas when certain teachings they found to be verified through reason, that they have the support of reason, they took them to be literal. And therefore, they rejected certain teachings to be literal while accepting others to be literal. And therefore, it is so this is not something that you find in the Pali tradition, but through your test and your experience, if you can actually verify the teaching, the truth of the teaching of the Buddha, this should be accepted, not otherwise. Now, therefore, in the teachings of the Buddha, writings of Master Nalanda, so forth, Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma Kosha talks about the cosmos with the Mount Meru and so forth. When we study logic, there are those of the types of logic which are called there are reasons that are used to actually refute others' positions, saying that, oh, if this were the case, since this is something that actually could be accessible to our perception, but they do not, we are not able to perceive them, therefore they cannot be accepted. While we use this kind of reasoning against other philosophical schools, other schools of thought, how can we actually go against reason ourselves? Because the Mount Meru is said to be something whose shadow falls on us, therefore, which means that we experience the shadow of Mount Meru, but saying that the Mount Meru cannot be seen, this is something contradictory. If Mount Meru did exist in this world, we must be able to see it with our eyes, or this must be perceptible to us. And so we cannot go against experience, empirical experience. Of course, if Mount Meru were somewhere else that we cannot see, I mean, it may be a different case. And so this is like following doing the scientific research where you, I mean, it's the scientists do not they do not just decide that something just because they have observed it. There must be there must not be only one person who has observed it, but it must be verified by others as well. And since according to the scientists, even scientists, when they are able to verify something, when something is verified by many tests followed, done by many people, and then they see it to be verifiable in this way, they accept it. And therefore, our way of doing this kind of investigation into the nature of things, reality, and so forth, is similar to scientists. So in the recent times, we have in our Tibetan communities monks and nuns studying science, and now science has become part of the monastic curriculum, and they have to actually sit for the monks and nuns as part of the Geshe exam, and have to sit for a test on science as well. And so we follow a very similar pattern of Buddhism in the Sanskrit tradition and the Nalanda tradition and science. And so the monastic centers in India have their own science lab where they do tests and so forth. So in the beginning, some elder monks were quite reluctant and hesitant to have this study of science for the monks and nuns. But as time went by, of course, with regard to the philosophical concepts that already are in Buddhism, there's nothing in, kind of a new that we can learn from science as such, but we can actually contribute to science from our science of mind, the emotions. And therefore, there are more and more people in, taking interest in learning from the Buddhist tradition about mind and emotions, because we can explain them on the basis of by using our intelligence and reason and logic. So the teaching that we are going to go through comes from Master Dharmakirti, who must have been a disciple of another disciple, himself a disciple of a disciple of Dignaga. And with regards to the four chapters of the Brahmana Vartika, of course, we cannot go through the whole of the book. I do not understand fully, but I will briefly go through the second chapter. Why I say this is because in the beginning of 1980s, one Russian, or in the 19th century, for example, in the beginning of the 20th century, I've heard that the Brahmana Vartika was translated by a Russian scholar.
When? That translation.
In the 1918.
Around
1918. I think Solnit is talking about Cherbatsky.
So just after First World War.
So,
no.
just after the First World War. So since I heard this, I felt admiration for this person, because there were not nobody really taking interest in such subjects. But he took interest and translated it. So this is like Cherbosky.
What is his name? Anyone, I think. Kasa.
Was it? Obermiller, no.
Okay. Difficult to pronounce. For me, impossible to pronounce that. So anyway, I really admire, you see, that
so
scholar.
It's all in the
chapati.
His Holiness hears the word as if it's tea leaves or chapati, Indian bread.
So then last year or before that, you see, we discuss what text should be. So then I mentioned, I will try.
So last year, His Holiness had a discussion about what text he should teach with the organizers.
The second chapter of...
And I decided to teach the second chapter of Paramanavartika Karika, the commentary on valid cognition. And so, in any case, that Russian scholar had... translated it into Russian, so I felt admiration and I really applaud him. So this is like in remembrance of that scholar that I thought of giving teaching on this text. Of course, we cannot go through the whole text and we will not be able to finish it either. So the second chapter is a commentary on the verse of salutation in Dignaga's compendium of the valid cognition. So in explanation of this verse, Master Dharmakirti, goes through the explanation proving the Buddha to be an authority or a reliable person, a pramana. Of course, in order to give a very good teaching on this text, I need to be very familiar with it, but I need also to sit for a retreat, in a retreat for a month, reading through these texts and commentaries and so forth, and then give teaching, but I do not have that leisure. Maybe I should say this also. So with regard to the 17 Nalanda Panditas, the scholars, scholar adepts, traditionally in Tibet we used to have a praise of the known as the six ornaments and two supreme masters of Nalanda. But because in Tibetan tradition, we study the writings of these 17 Nalanda masters, like Buddha Palita and Chandrakirti. And Chandrakshita, as well as Vimukti Sena, Haribhadra, So we do study texts written by these masters, and therefore I had felt that there's need for writing a prayer or to these masters. And then, these masters became, and therefore I wrote the praise of the 17 Nalanda masters, and we follow these teachings of these masters. So in one of the Tibetan masters has said with regard to the teaching of the Buddha that there are certain teachings which touch the general structure of the teaching of the Buddha, emphasizing the general structure, and then there are those teachings which are specifically emphasizing specifically tailored teachings. So these writings of these 17 Nalanda masters pertain to the former types of teaching, whereas in the case of the latter type of teaching, we have the Buddha arising in the form of the mandala deities and then giving those tantric esoteric teachings. And when these tantric teachings were given, the Buddha gave them in accordance with the physiological structure and the character, the interests, and so forth, the predispositions of the disciple themselves, the structure of the bindus, channels, and drops, and the mortal energy of those disciples to whom these tantric teachings were given. Therefore, tantric teachings are those teachings specifically tailored for individuals. And then the other writings on, teachings on tantra are of the similar type. And therefore, in order to really be able to understand and follow the practices such as the yoga with signs and yoga without signs and so forth, which are very specifically tailored for individuals, cannot be taken, cannot be generalized. Whereas in order to really be able to be effective in the practice of tantric teachings, you have to understand the general structure. And therefore, in the Tibetan tradition, we have in this the 13 classics, and also in the Pelnul tradition, they also have the 18 different classic texts. So there were, of course, many institutions of learning in Tibet which study all these classic texts which touch on the general structure. But there were thousands of other monasteries which have just ritual practices. And so people were not really learning the general structure of the teaching of the Buddha, but doing some kind of a ritual and then deity yoga practice, and there was nobody really explaining to them these different practices, and people themselves didn't take interest. Although Buddhism spread the length and breadth of Tibet, there were very few who actually studied the teaching of the Buddha well, and therefore I felt that there's need to be changed. And therefore, after coming 10 years or so after coming into exile, I actually suggested, advised the monastic institutions like the which have this practice of ritual, tantric ritual. Appealed to them to or suggested to them to study the philosophy. And so many of these tantric monasteries did take up the study of philosophy. And not only that, I have also suggested nunneries to study philosophy. And therefore, today we have nuns who have completed their Geshe degree, and at the end of this year, and in December, when I'm going to give them the Geshe-ma degree to them, so these nuns have studied for over 20 years Buddhist philosophy. So we should not just say that we are Buddhists because our parents were Buddhists. I mean, this should not be our attitude. We need to really understand what the teaching of the Buddha is and then do the practice and not just take something for granted, saying that this is our traditional religion. Of course, in the West, in Europe and America and so forth, they have their own, you have your own traditional religions, which are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And so it is very important for you to be sincere, whichever religion you follow, your traditional religion being the coming from the Judeo-Christian background, you need to be really sincere in practicing your religion. Buddhism comes from Asia, so converting to another religion, for example, Buddhism in your case in the West, I mean, it may not be good sometimes because people could have psychological, emotional disturbances. Whereas in the East, we have Buddhism in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, and so forth, which have the Theravada tradition. And then in Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, and so forth, we have the Sanskrit tradition. And we in the case of Tibet and Mongolia, Tibet and also Buryat and so forth, you have that your traditional religion is Buddhism, and also this includes Buryat and Tuva and Kalmykia. So there have been many great scholars from these regions, Mongolia and the republics within the Russian Federation. So some of the texts that I study were written by the masters from these regions. And so this Buddhism is your own traditional religion. In the European continent, there are people, even scientists and scholars, who take interest in the teaching of the Buddha. So, of course, if people study the teaching of the Buddha and then they find it to be beneficial for them, I mean, it's good. And even if you convert to Buddhism, you should still be able to keep your respect to the other religious traditions, your own traditional religions. Must not criticize them. It's not good. It's going to be good. It's not going to be good to criticize, but you must respect them because these other religions also help many people. And because if you are able to feel convinced that Buddhism is the religion that is meant for you, of course you can follow it. So today I tell people who are traditionally Buddhist that they must become 21st century Buddhists, which means that they must study the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, on the basis of which, understanding which, then you should also learn about the path which comprise the method and wisdom. So wisdom, which is related to that of emptiness, selflessness, and the method, which is related to the practice of love, compassion, bodhicitta. And so these are very, very helpful and beneficial to us. And so With regard to this is also many of my friends also have the same experience. So when you train your minds in love and compassion and through the understanding of equality and exchanging self and others, it will help to reduce the intensity of your self-centered, extreme self-centeredness. And because of this, as a result of it, you can have a peace of mind and have more friends, gain more friends. But this method principle must be conjoined with the wisdom principle. And so, of course, within the wisdom, there could be wisdom of understanding impermanence and so forth, but the main wisdom that we are talking about is this wisdom of selflessness. Because what happens so far with us, has happened with us so far, is that we have relied on self-cherishing, extreme self-cherishing attitude, and also grasping at an independent existence, which have kind of worked hand in hand with themselves. And therefore, we need to understand the selflessness, which helps in reducing the exaggerated way of looking at things, fantasizing about things, or inappropriate thinking, and which in turn helps to reduce our hate, love and hate kind of emotions. And so, with regard to this, I met an American psychiatrist named Aaron Beck, and he was in his 80s, and 2 years ago, I purposely made a visit to him, and he is someone who has worked to help people with psychiatric problems. Of course, he is not live alone being Buddhist, he is not even a religious person. So he was someone who was helping people with psychiatric problems. So from his decades of experience, he said, told me that when we become angry at something or somebody, the object looks utterly negative. But 90% of that negativeness in the is our own mental projection. This is what he said. So this is similar to what Master Nagarjuna has said. So something pleasant, attractive, or unattractive also is our projection through distorted view. So when we become attached to something, or we become angry at something or somebody, I mean, what we actually hold on to is what appears to us. And therefore, when you understand that things do not exist, whether attractive or unattractive or repulsive, I mean, do not exist the way they appear to us. And so this is something very similar to what Nagarjuna has called. What Aaron Beck says is very similar to what Nagarjuna says. So when we have some negative emotions, they arise because of our self-cherishing attitude, and this is in turn, which is in turn helped or backed by this called the clinging to some independent existence in things. So if we could actually reduce this, understand that things do not exist the way they appear to us, it helps to reduce our inappropriate mentation, which in turn helps to reduce our attachment and anger. So Master Aryadeva has said that someone who actually doubts about the teaching, the hidden teaching of the Buddha, must be introduced to the teaching of the Buddha by teaching on emptiness. So with regards to the introduction of the teaching of the Buddha, of course, we cannot do so on the basis of taking refuge or love and compassion or tolerance and contentment and self-discipline. These are common to other religious traditions. So selflessness teaching or selflessness, is it something that these great masters have written on them to show off their own originality of thinking, or just for writing some thesis, or what? So if we have calm state of mind, it helps us with our health, and that in turn helps us for our longevity. So when we talk about future life, even in this life, I mean, we need to still live calmly. Just yesterday, I met someone who told me that he had met me 20 plus years ago. And I asked him, do you see change in my face? And he said, no, your face looks same. So many friends like that tell me like that, that they, and then therefore they ask me, what is your secret? And so I kind of respond by saying, oh, I will not tell this because this is my secret. But actually I tell them that I sleep every night. I sleep 8 to 9 hours and get up early morning. And I actually analyze the teaching of the Buddha, mainly bodhicitta, reflecting on bodhicitta and emptiness. And so because of this, I am able to maintain a calm state of mind throughout the day. Even if I become a little bit emotional by hearing all kinds of news and tragic news, which could provoke disturbance of mind. I mean, they do not provoke such thing in me. So I tell people that I sleep a lot and I reflect and in a critical way reflect on the teachings and these principles. And so this really, in reality, is helpful too. One's physical health as well. So if you also wish to have good health and long life, without talking about nirvana and omniscience and so forth, in order to live peacefully and calmly, you need to study the teaching of the Buddha and meditate on these principles. Of course, for Buddhist, you think about using this practice and teaching for nirvana and omniscience. If you are able to actually turn the tragedy into something positive, then you have the benefit. Just as we take care of our health, in terms of hygiene, we need also the practice of hygiene of our mind. I mean, have the knowledge. And so in order to understand that, we need to learn about the workings of the mind. And therefore, after understanding the workings of mind and the emotions, we need to understand what can actually counter those factors which otherwise cause us problems and disturbance in our mind. So we need to find the counterfactors to those things and experiences which cause disturbance of mind.
Virus
So when we have certain bacteria or viruses and we need to take the medicine that can counter those, and therefore we also, similarly, we need to know those emotions which disturb our mind and our health. For example, regarding health, with regard to anger, if you just pray, may this anger go away, it will not go away. You need to understand how anger arises, that it arises from our projection of something which is not there, something negative in the person or thing that is not actually there, and then become angry. So when you become angry, it's not just because of one single factor, but there are many different factors working to give rise to that anger. But when you actually become angry, you don't see that reality, fact that the anger arises through. You are provoked anger by many different factors coming together. So if you are able to see from a wider perspective, you will see that it doesn't come from just a single cause. So these negative emotions usually don't see things from a wider perspective, just see them from one angle. Therefore, we should learn about the workings of our mind. And so in Tibet, of course, people became interested in Buddhism in the 7th century through our marital relations with the Chinese emperors. But in the 8th century, Nalanda monastic institution was quite well known, and therefore in the 8th century, Master Chandrakshita, the great abbot, was invited to Tibet. And so, together with Master the great abbot Chandrakshita, there was Master Padmasambhava, and then the Tibetan emperor Tisong Detsen invited them, of course. And so, Master Chandrakshita took the responsibility in teaching, explaining the teaching of the Buddha, and also helping with the translations, and then also monastic ordination. So with regard to him, Master Chandrakshita himself wrote the Tatup Samgraha. Chandrakshita wrote Tatup Samgraha. And so, amongst the great text on epistemology and logic, one of them is Master Chandrakshita's Tatup Samgraha, Compendium of Reality. And so he was a great logician and also a follower of the Madhyamaka, the middle ways philosophy. And amongst the Madhyamaka philosophical sub-schools, he was a follower of Savatantrika Madhyamaka school, and particularly the Yogacara Savatantrika Madhyamaka. And so his writings, another writing is Madhyamaka Alankara, the ornament of the middle way. And so these are great texts written by him. So he was a great, someone who really took great interest in logic. So with his help, the study and of the teaching of the Buddha started in Tibet. So the study regarding the study of logic and reasoning, it is not there in China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam, as it is so prevalent in Tibetan tradition. And through Tibet, of course, the study of Buddhism spread also to Mongolia and then the other places like within the Russian Federation, Buryatia, Kalmykia, and Tuva, and you also have the same tradition. today, with regard to the study of epistemology text on logic and reason, it is only in the Tibetan tradition. And with regard to the explaining Buddhist philosophy, the best language today is Tibetan. Sanskrit may be have become dead language, and other languages, European languages, and English and so forth may not be adequate. So Buddhism, Tibetan language is the best religion, best language, to explain Buddhism, Buddhist philosophy. And we have over 100 volumes of the translation of the Buddha's words of the Buddha, and then over 220 volumes of the exegetical texts, treatises written by Indian masters. And then the sub-commentaries to these texts, over 300 volumes that have come from India, and there are over 20,000 texts written by Indian Tibetan masters. So, of course, Tibetan masters really worked hard to explain these treatises and the words of the Buddha, but compared to their hard work and writing all these texts, within the Tibetan community, there were not as many scholars who understood the teaching of the Buddha well. And the scholars themselves lived in their own monastic cocoon, and there is a story that happened in Tibet. One person came to meet an abbot of a monastery, and the abbot was not present in the monastery, and the visitor said he wanted to see them. He has to see the abbot of the monastery, and an attendant of the abbot told him that today the abbot is not here, but he went to actually scare the elderly people in the town. So the teachings that we have given to people traditionally emphasized on how to actually create fear in people, saying, oh, you have to keep faith in the Lama, and if you don't do so, you'll go to hell. I mean, this I find to be faulty. So we have a very excellent teaching of the Buddha in the land of snows, but we have lacked in effort from the amongst the general public, lacked effort to really make them understand, aware of the teaching well. And therefore, I usually say that when it comes to the general public in the Tibetan community, we have followed the teaching according to what is known as the system of the dull-witted people, the people with dull faculty, intellect. So I've been telling in my teachings in India that if we follow the system followed by people with sharp faculty, then which means that if we follow the teaching of the Buddha based on reason and logic, the teaching of the Buddha will live for several centuries at least. Whereas if we follow the based on blind faith, then I don't know how long the teaching of the Buddha will survive. So with regard to this preservation of the teaching, we need the public, the common people, to really understand the teaching of the Buddha well through logic and reason. So otherwise, how can we talk about preserving the teaching of the Buddha well?
Is
So this teaching So Master Dharmakirti wrote seven texts, three which are considered like a body, which are those of the Pramana Vartika, and then middle length Pramana Pramana Vinishchaya, and then the short text, which is the Nayaya Bindu. And then there are the four texts which are derivatives of these main body-like texts. So in The Door of Logic by Master Dignaga, he goes through these eight types of logic. He goes to the eight topics, which are called the manifest, the direct cognition, and then inference, and then those of the those which are pseudo direct cognition, and then also pseudo inference. And then he also mentions the syllogisms, some kind of a making some statement, and also using a reductio ad absurdum logic. First, when people have doubt about something, and then having used that, using formal logic, saying that things do not have. So when you use a reductio ad absurdum, it dispels your doubt about the reality of the things that you want to understand, and then you use those of the formal syllogisms, so which are called Dumgak and Sunjin, and those of the formal logics and the syllogisms. And he also touches the opposites of these four. And in the Brahmana Samuchaya, Master Dignaga says, the one who has become a reliable guide to the one who has transformed into the reliable guide, and therefore in the second chapter of Dharmakirti, he says, valid cognition is awareness which is non-deceptive. What remains as functional is non-deceptive. And therefore, when it comes to talking about valid cognition, it is a type of cognition or awareness which actually goes together with the reality. So this valid cognition is non-mistaken in terms, in relation to the object, apprehended object. So if you are realistic, and your efforts to attain or to achieve something, goal is, will also be realistic. So without being able to be realistic in your understanding, or you can't approach the things realistically. So you need to understand the reality of how things are. And then, with regard to the effect, there is the effect which comes directly from the valid cognition, and those via something, some other factor. So if we wish to attain some fruit, we need to engage in the right courses. So you need need to understand what are the right causes, the causes that can give rise to certain effect or fruit. Without really understanding the causes that can give rise to that effect that you actually aspire, I mean, merely doing something, whatever comes about, and you know, doing that will not really give rise to the effect that you actually want. Therefore, in our life, if we could work on the causes well, and then we could actually find that you call obtain the result well, and therefore with the result, with regard to the result or the effect that you aspire, there could be a direct effects, and also there could be indirect effects, which means that there are other factors that could be working in between the result and the causes. And therefore, in order to have the effect well, then you need to actually work on the causes so that you don't face those obstacles in between. So we regard education very important in today's world. Why? Because we want happiness, joy and happiness. And this comes through education and knowledge. And so this also comes down to the point of talking about the valid cognition, valid knowledge, and its effect. So a valid cognition is an awareness which actually perceives the object correctly, precisely. So before going further, we need to be to have the our fill. So we need to know what we need to do now to fill, have our fill, so that we could actually enjoy the effect later. So here also we can talk about valid cognition and its result. So we'll resume at 1 o'clock. We have 1.5 hour for meal, lunch. Thank you.